Welcome to the Settle Cane Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Smith, broadcasting from the Aorta of America, beautiful festival city, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where we pump out reason and pierce through the propaganda. Here we go. Today is Sunday, October 8th, 2023, and I'm firing it back up, hopefully on all cylinders. I've had some time away, and I think that I have a better plan of attack to achieve this bucket list goal of mine of writing a book. The book itself has not seen a lot of pages written, but that's life, but it's coming along. What I've lacked in pages written, I guess I could say I've gained in perspective and organization and even planning. So not a total loss. Hopefully this little exercise here has just been a learning experience. And in any event, it was very helpful. It was very helpful and I feel really good about it. But I just felt like I had to get back and jump back in the saddle and do what I do best. And apparently that's just talk your ears off. So this is episode 54 of the Settle Cane Podcast, Crosstown Traffic. If you're new to the Settle Cane Podcast, thank you for gracing us with your virtual presence. And if you're a returning listener, thank you for your continued support. It is much appreciated. So let's see. Since the last time we met, I believe we've seen some more catastrophe, tragedy, corruption, possibly some propaganda. So I guess pretty much business as usual. Not that there isn't a lot going on in the world, certainly is, but you know what I mean, business as usual. I suppose that won't change too much. We kind of always have a buffet of lamentations to feast upon, don't we? And our sort of bloated and morbid hosts, they provide a wide variety of dishes for us to choose from, and they strongly encourage us to keep coming back for more. There you go, sir. Would you like a refill on that misery to complement the abject fear we've served you? Sometimes I think it's helpful to think of legacy and social media like a big old golden corral. Well, hopefully I don't get in trouble for outing a restaurant. But if you're not familiar, the Golden Corral is sort of like this chain of franchise-based buffet-style restaurants. Around these parts, we fondly refer to it as the Golden Trough. And to sort of torture the analogy, everyone has their favorite dish. And it's generally whatever causes the most indigestion or, in the case of media, indignation. I suppose it's a hell of a lot more easy to shake our fists at the sky, though, and rage against the machine than it is to attend to our own flaws and shortcomings. That's even if we're brave enough to face them in the first place. Now, I say that knowing that it doesn't exclude the necessity of pointing out immoral or unethical agendas or narratives. It does not. That's very important work. And friends of ours, other podcasts I listen to, people I've spoken with, do an awesome job of that. It's very important work. I'm not trying to downplay that. What I'm trying to say, I guess, is when we do that, if we do that, understanding that we have our own flaws and shortcomings, it helps us, I think, to do so with a modicum of humility and a recognition of our own culpability. I think that's important. And I know, you know, we're being told that the sky is falling and that the weather gods are very angry with us and that people are generally running around with hate-filled blackened hearts. But if we pay close attention, which I've been trying to do, pay close attention to the people around me in my daily life and IRL, as the kids are saying, or so I'm told, I notice that people are, they're kind of just basically going about their days and working and sleeping and eating and playing and trying to fight for something better, much as they have our whole lives, despite all the different things we see on the media and all the different things that we hear about. And it's kind of like that's business as usual as well. And in many, many ways, in many human ways. And that can almost seem like a controversial thing to say right now because we're so hyper-focused on what we're told to be focused on, you know, running around like a bull with a ring in our nose. And even if you accept that things are not as bad as we're being told that they are, it's likely that underneath it all, you still believe that something is really wrong. And I do too. I do too. And I accept it. I accept it. But it's hard to accept that life is not really that different from day to day, you know, apart from personal tragedies or massive things that happen. It's really not, you know. Obviously, look what's going on in other countries like, you know, Ukraine. There's a lot of people dying despite the geopolitical reasoning why things are happening. There's a lot of suffering going on, or what just happened in Israel. And, you know, I'm not really sure what I'm seeing, but I know that there's obviously some innocent people are suffering because of that. And that's important to recognize. But here's a question. Regardless, does the reality that's presented to me through media, or let's say trainings that I'm mandated to participate in at work, does that actually seem to align with my personal experience in the real world? And I'd say largely no. No, it does not. According to the dominant narratives that are promoted by government and media, the world is just an absolutely terrifying and terrible place full of constant threats to our security. Natural disasters seem to be popping up like never before, never before. Every severe weather is a historic event, and every illness seems to be a pandemic, and every single problem just must be existential. Isn't that all a bit much, though? I mean, at what point are they sort of overplaying the hand here? I mean, remember that story about the boy who cried wolf? I gotta be honest, I was thinking about this. Things have gotten so dramatized and hyperbolic that I don't know, will people even be ready for any real tragedy when it comes? Are they ready when it happens? Or are we going to be too exhausted from anxiety to even deal with the actual traumatic event when it does show up? Like I said, obviously there are traumatic events going on, and wars and natural disasters. I'm not dismissing them. What I'm addressing is the disproportionate amount of time we're focusing on what could happen to us than what actually is happening. And after a while, it starts turning into white noise. And so we have to keep on cranking it up, don't we? Just keep cranking it up. And the fear porn went from showing a little cleavage to hardcore S&M, if you like that really crazy analogy. But what's next? I mean, come on. How many world-ending apocalyptic prognostications can we be expected to take seriously? How'd that recent emergency broadcast that was supposed to start the zombie apocalypse or whatever, or activate the mRNA, how'd that turn out? Crickets. Just crickets. I think the point is that the white noise, in a way, actually has me more concerned than the problems I'm being told we're facing. Because at some point, just scaring people with the threat of something terrible just isn't going to be enough. For example, maybe not a good example, but for example, I'm shooting from the hip here. If I threaten to give someone a beating for doing something that I don't like, And I threaten them over and over and over again, but I never actually provide said beating. You know, I'm not advocating beatings, but let's say I just constantly keep on threatening them with a beating if they don't stop. And they don't stop, and I don't give them the beating. Well, the people I'm threatening, they're just going to shrug their shoulders eventually, and they're going to tell me to get bent because, well, not really impressed with your beating. Because I haven't delivered the beating. So likewise, the people threatening us with constant catastrophes to sort of elicit their desired responses and behaviors, they're going to have to escalate things eventually for us to start taking them seriously again. That's what kind of has me worried, because threats without action do have a diminishing return. And we're being threatened with some pretty nasty stuff on the regular. So eventually, unfortunately, I think the self-appointed parents in this dysfunctional family we call society are going to realize that talk is cheap and really unload on us when we least expect it. People are always referencing Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World. I'm not exempt. We make connections to the Ministry of Truth and the drug Soma quite regularly, and with good reason, I think. Good reason. But unfortunately, One of the effects of that is that it becomes more of a meme that acts as a pressure release valve for us. And we generally have stopped imagining what real totalitarianism looks like, because it's clown world and it's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? But what happens is we've made a caricature of tyranny. And while it is cathartic to turn our devils into clowns, it's also easy to start believing that the clowns are funny. You know, we post clever memes online and joke about addled presidents. We snicker at the ridiculous middle-aged man who insists he's a pretty lady. Again, it's cathartic, but it's also dangerous. I think the real threat amongst the onslaught of invented ones is a sense of complacency that because something is outlandish, that it can't be dangerous. Jordan Peterson's been sort of comparing the devil to a demented clown or jester. And I like the sentiment, I do, and he makes some really wise and relevant points about it, but we ought not confuse Ronald McDonald and Pennywise, or we're going to be likely staring into the deadlights. If you don't know that particular reference, Stephen King's horror tale It, go ahead, pause it, do a little search, be prepared. So, well, Aaron, you might say, you started by telling us the world isn't as dangerous as we're told it is, and then quickly shifted to telling us that it's potentially more dangerous than we previously believed. I suppose yes and no. What I'm trying to say, if I'm saying anything at all, is that there's a real chance the clown world we're presented is a sleight of hand or a red herring. Don't get me wrong, clowns abound. There are myriad examples of sincere lunatics prancing around through the court. I'm just proposing that the real threat is generally the one you don't see coming. It's not hard to capitalize on people's fears or insecurities. We all have plenty. We all do. And now we have complex algorithms that probe our psyches for them and then deliver manifestations of them in a host of variations to keep us at the edge of our seat and wanting more, always more. We're addicted to the trauma and the drama, and it's like an endless, demented game of peekaboo. Again, for the sake of the critics, I'm not excluding myself from this trap. I'm just trying to acknowledge that it exists. In life, there's a tenuous balance between chaos and order. And when we lean too hard into order, we end up excluding all of the creativity and personal liberty, otherwise known as tyranny. But when we lean too far into anarchy, we end up with chaos. An absence of rulers doesn't necessarily mean, but can easily turn into, an absence of leaders. An absence of leaders can quickly become survival of the fittest. We might not need rulers, but we always will need leaders. And not surprisingly, as our good friend Froda reminds us in his book, Bill Goats in the Forest, there is a balance to be had. So what about authority? Well, who has authority? Or maybe a better question is, what is authority? The etymology of the word authority allows for some variation in definition, but I like the Middle English meaning best, and we're going to use it here. And that is sort of power derived from good reputation, or the capacity for inspiring trust and the power to convince people because of that. Authority in that sense, to be an authority on a topic, let's say, is that it means that you are something like properly equipped to posit reliable information on that given topic. Leaders should be authorities. They should be properly equipped to provide reliable advice to the people who follow them. As a very wise man I served under overseas used to say all the time, leadership is a position of responsibility, not of privilege. Much to the chagrin of the officers he served under at times. Who is a leader then? And who is a follower? This is a relationship, by the way, that can only ever truly be valid if it's consensual. This is not some autocrat sitting in an ivory tower mandating behaviors that serve their particular needs or vision of utopia. True leaders inspire trust in their followers by genuinely and consistently providing reliable and mutually beneficial advice. True leaders walk the talk. True leaders eat last. It's a position of responsibility, not of privilege. And their authority should reflect their competence and never be a product of force. The second a leader uses coercion and fear to gain compliance, they have surrendered their right to lead. They have become tyrants, and tyrants should be removed from their positions with a quickness. You don't need a guillotine either. Everyone needs to just stop listening to them, and their power will evaporate along with their credibility. In the Gospels, Jesus is asked by critics of his who were trying to trap him whether it is lawful to pay Caesar taxes. Jesus asks to see a denarius, the coin in use at the time. And he asks, well, whose likeness is on that coin? Well, Caesar's, they say. Well, then give Caesar what's Caesar's and give God what's God's. That silenced them for the time being. I've actually, and sadly, heard Christians sort of use this verse to justify total and complete compliance to just about every whim of the government. I find this problematic for several reasons. The most important one seems to be that they haven't really stopped to ponder about what is Caesar's and what is God's. I'm just going to venture a guess here, but I'd guess that the lion's share of our lives belong to our Creator, and Caesar basically just gets to keep the change. Leadership, again, is a position of responsibility, not privilege. And leaders should eat last. It's a good principle. Each and every one of you can be a real leader. You don't need sergeant stripes. You don't need fancy titles or degrees. You need integrity and a firm grip on how best to serve those around you. In order to do that, you need a firm grip on the proper orientation for your life. Real leadership is actually service. The first will be last, and the last will be first. In the book of Matthew, this is made explicit. Quote, "The greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted." End quote. That's Matthew 23:11. The last will be first, and the first will be last. Real leadership, combined with legitimate authority of the type we discussed earlier, is more like a trusted friend advising you about a decision. One who has relevant experience that might help you navigate your situation. And there's something sincere and benevolent about that. There's an innate, humble reciprocity that recognizes and respects your individuality, your autonomy. That's the kind of relationship that can actually promote a shared dream. Real leadership is very different from, if not entirely antithetical to, the arrogant paternal coercion we see from a majority of our quote-unquote leaders. Somehow, and I know that it's highly complex and nuanced, but somehow, many of us have accepted that there are people who have the right to enforce their ideology upon us. We are regularly witness to tragic irony on this front. Let me expound on that, or at least try to. Hypothetically, if, let's say, the end goal is to disrupt the nuclear family and dismantle the traditional structures in our society, okay? In that case, that being the goal, then it's totally permissible to push drag queen reading hours and puberty blockers on children. But, same goal in mind, in service of the same narrative, it's perfectly acceptable to trample all over religious liberty or freedom of speech and just shout you down as a bigot if you don't want those nice men sexualizing your children in high heels and garter belts. Just an example. I'll pivot before I get too sidetracked. The effect, regardless of the mechanism which brings it about, is that the rules of the game, so to speak, can be tailored to serve an agenda. Rather than reflect the desires of the people being subjected to it. What happens is there's no fixed point. The rules have no connection to anything transcendent, and so they are as fluid as the whims of the people who enforce them. We saw this with the constantly shifting science of lockdowns and mandates. One of the contributing factors that allowed for such a drastic shift in the paradigm is that we as a society are, as Neil Postman so deftly stated, amusing ourselves to death. Amusement, remember, being the opposite of thoughtful contemplation. And I'm not sure how a population this amused finds their way out of this algorithmic abyss. And that's what it is at its heart. It's an algorithmic abyss of meaning. On that happy note, I'm going to take a short break here and say that the Subtle Cane podcast is a value for value operation. And I know I've been out of commission for a little while, and so I'm just going to mention this. I don't take advertising money to cover my time and expenses, and it's only the generosity of you, my producers, that helps me with this endeavor. Links are in the show notes if you're interested in supporting the show financially. Also, please subscribe, share, let people know about it. I don't do advertising myself either, and so word of mouth and people sharing on whatever whatever you use to share information with, whether it's email or social media or whatever you got, please share. Consider sharing the show. Your talent, your time, and your treasure always, always welcome here and appreciated. So in my last episode, I shared that I would be taking this break that I did between episodes. And despite that fact, despite that he knew I wasn't going to be doing anything for a little while, producer Caleb came through with a $100 donation via GiveSendGo. And I know that I've thanked you personally, Caleb, but I also wanted to give you public acknowledgement because, well, you deserve it. Not that you were looking for it, but I wanted to do that. I think that that is the right thing to do. And Caleb's been a real blessing to me and to the show. And what an awesome thing that it's been able to bring me together. And now I, not only do I have a supporter of the show, but I have a good friend. And thank you. And thank you for all of you that help out with things like things behind the scenes, like a producer in Houston. I'm truly always inspired by your confidence and your support. So that's that. Okay, back to it. I have said before, in fact, in my last episode, that we're seeing that what we're seeing in the world is a product of a spiritual conflict, not just a difference of opinion between people. And maybe you share that belief, maybe you don't. But I think it's an important enough distinction that it bears repeating. One of the important elements of that is this dogmatic acceptance of the idea that we're merely like the accidental byproduct of genetic mutation. And I don't think that that's served us well, not practically speaking. Look around you. The strictly materialistic secular humanism that's been largely accepted by Western society has effectively unmoored us from any moral anchor point we used to commonly hold. What's been the actual effect of this? Well, a strong inverse correlation between the loss of faith and the increase in despair, anxiety, and even suicide and overdoses. And perhaps this begs the question then, why? We are often told in science class that what separates us from the animals is just our self-awareness, and that this is the product of certain biological changes to our brains, which provided us with advantages over simpler forms of life. And if that's true, that benefit maybe has now been lost. And maybe that's causing a tipping of the scales, resulting in a suicidal tendency in our species. Some people actually believe that to be the case and argue that we've sort of outlived our usefulness on this planet. They propose that we either course correct through guided evolution or go the way of the Neanderthal. And I suppose it's a theory. But has our intellect then become deleterious rather than beneficial? Is it like an autoimmune disorder? Has our intellect, which once protected us from the elements and the animals, now turned on us? Has what was once protective become pathological? And these are questions that need to be asked if people are content to write off any supernatural explanation for human life or cognition. Oftentimes, it's sort of written off as a juvenile delusion of our species. If that's the case, then is there a way to reimagine the future in a way that restores meaning and hope? I mean, that's sort of the message of transhumanists like Yuval Noah Harari. They dream of a technocratic utopia where man melds with machine and death is replaced with software updates. And I'm not sure how a perpetually prolonged maintenance of increasingly meaningless lives sounds appealing to anybody, but I guess there will be plenty of drugs and video games to get us through, so says Harari. But what good is immortality in service of oneself? I don't know. And maybe this train of thought seems a little unnecessarily abstract or unrelated or rambling. I don't know. But this is all tied to the balance between chaos and order. It's all tied to authority and leadership. And I think in the things we've been talking about, in this constant shell game we have of catastrophes that we're being fed, we've all been so preoccupied with the who, what, when, and where that we can literally just forget about the why. And I don't think the why is trivial. The why varies greatly for people, I suppose. It can be as simple as, why do you do the right thing? Well, because it's the right thing to do. Or to the ever-loving greater good, that can be the why for people. But how about because the experts say so? That's also the why for lots of people. And that, in my mind, is the ultimate abdication of personal investment in life. But people are suffering out there. They're suffering out there behind their masks and their screens. And I'm not talking about surgical masks either. No, I'm talking about the masks we wear to conform to the people around us. You know, we're told to celebrate diversity, but rather than being handed a paintbrush and a canvas and a palette, we're pretty much just given a coloring book and a small box of crayons with strict instructions to stay within the lines. And the same people declaring religion to be oppressive are perfectly comfortable living within the confines of the crowdsourced panopticon of social justice and media. Real life, real meaningful life, is like art, not some exercise in symmetry. You know, instead of conquering the open seas through dialogue and genuine debate, I feel like we're stuck in this overchlorinated pool doing synchronized swimming to elevator music. Freedom, we're told, is the ability to act on our fantasies and be granted immediate gratification, when really that's just the tyranny of oneself. You know, it's like being chained to the Freudian id, watching the shadows on the wall of the cave, you know, and we're encouraged to find ourselves through navel gazing and pharmaceuticals. You find yourself in the struggle and the shared purpose in life with the people around you. Anyway, maybe our why should be something more substantial, more transcendent. Maybe that would provide a more meaningful answer to the question. The key to hope is a proper orientation of priorities with a fixed goal and a means to obtain it. It's a continuous series of course corrections for ourselves, not the people around us. That's the difference between liberty and tyranny. We personally strive for something by aligning ourselves to a purpose higher than ourselves without forcing anybody else to. Personal accountability versus collective conformity and coercion. Much of our understanding of the world is mediated through symbols, isn't it? Or the interpretation of symbols. And the idea that complex concepts can be distilled into simple designs, I think, is a marvel. It's used against us often as well in propaganda, but it isn't always a bad thing. In fact, stop and go lights are helpful. Think about letters. Flags are also powerful symbols. They all kind of provide us a shortcut to cognition. And in the age of information and advertising, my goodness, we are pummeled by a barrage of symbols constantly. Symbols that can unite or divide. Some are more powerful and represent visual manifestations of our allegiances, and they move us. They move us. But what symbols are most representative of the ideals to which we ought to aspire? And do they represent in reality what they purport to? Don't get me started on the distance between the flag and what it's supposed to represent, between them what the reality is of what it's representing. Not surprisingly, I suppose, as a Christ follower, the symbol that most moves me is that of the cross. Now, whether or not you share my faith, I hope that you will be open to hearing why I believe the cross to be such an ultimate symbol for orienting one's life. When Jesus is asked by some other disingenuous critics what the greatest of all commandments is, he responds by explaining in the spirit of the law versus the letter of the law. He says that first and foremost, we're to love the Lord God with all our heart and soul and mind. And secondly, we should love our neighbors as ourselves. And he says all of the law and the prophets hinge on those two concepts. And you say, oh, okay, Aaron, but what's that got to do with anything else? Well, let's talk about it. We've gone over leadership, authority, and the proper orientation for life, and what symbol most closely represents the ideals to which we ought to aspire. As fallen imagers of a heavenly God, in the Christian worldview, we're planted into the earth, in our mortality, and all the accompanying hardship and limitations we face are part of that reality. And the base of the cross represents this, planted into the ground. The sinful, carnal base of our life is represented by the base of the cross planted into the ground. And from that lowly base, the cross extends into the heavens, representing the vertical orientation that we are to have to the Father. The reality of our situation and our failings is abundantly clear as we look down. And as we look up, the recognition of this is in stark contrast to the open sky above. Without the base, we wouldn't recognize the need to rise above it. Christ hung on that cross and he looked to heaven and he cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? And in that moment, as he unjustly took on the sins of the world, he felt the separation between the ideal and the reality of mortality. The vertical plane of the cross perfectly represents the first part of his answer to the critics. In utter submission to the will of the Father, he surrendered temporal comfort for eternal purpose. And no matter what the cost, we are to align ourselves with the will of the Father, trusting that his eternal plan can transcend the temporal circumstances of our life. And that's what you call leading by example. And it's only too perfect that Jesus was hung between two others. Because horizontally, the second part of his answer was made clear. The golden rule we hear called, love thy neighbor as thyself. Supported by the vertical axis of a proper orientation, the horizontal axis represents this heavenly mandate. Anchored by the recognition of our sin, we are to look to the heavens and extend our reach to those around us. The cross is the great equalizer. No one comes to the Father but by me, Jesus said. It is the ultimate symbol of proper orientation. We are to be situated at the axis of the cross in our life. And we each have our own cross to bear. And we're each equally unable to do so. And that's why we have a Savior. This is the Christian worldview. This is what my faith as a Christ follower tells me. And that is why we can face the many hardships that we're presented with. The why is because he lives. We can expect to be ridiculed and to have our liberties attacked by those who align themselves to the symbol of the dollar or even a flag. The distractions are endless, and the buffet has a large variety of pleasures and pains to indulge in. The greatest threats are almost always the ones that you don't see coming, and it can be easy to get caught up in the manic race to uncover the next nefarious plot. God knows there are plenty, and I'm not saying that it doesn't pay to be skeptical or to investigate and to inform people. That would just be hypocritical of me. What I'm saying is that we will never figure it all out, and there's a difference between being aware of your surroundings and being terrified of them. The symbol of the cross is one that brings me peace, and I want that for you. And I know that I'm not alone in life, and neither are you. This life can be hard, and seeing injustice all around us can really dishearten the most stalwart of souls. I know it can, but we have to choose to be leaders. Each and every one of us, in whatever way we can. And we do that best by serving those around us. There's a way we all can do it too. It looks different for everybody because we're all individual personalities, but there's something we can all be doing. I know I bounced around a bit here. Maybe I was a little long-winded, but perhaps as a consequence of the time I spent between episodes and just being a little bit rusty here, but I hope that this was helpful in some small way. And that you've received it in the same spirit that it was offered. That is a sincere desire to encourage you. And I also, by the way, sincerely hope that you were not amused. I'm going to leave you with this quote from Nicholas Berdyaev, a Russian philosopher. Quote, the distinction between the things of Caesar and the things of God is constantly being erased in our fallen world. And this always indicates that the kingdom of Caesar is attempting to swallow up the kingdom of God, end quote. For all you listening, you are valued, you are loved, and you are worthy. God bless, and good night.
Back once the fire's lit, let the embers glow and be done with it. I'm startled by my lack of fear as the world I love.